I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by PGA Tour Champions star and former PGA Tour winner, Paul Goidos. Paul, thanks for coming on.
Good, thanks. Star, it kind of caught me off guard, but Journeyman's been more the title, but I'll take Star for this time.
Hey, you got some wins on the Champions Tour.
I do have a couple, yeah.
You know, former assistant Ryder Cup captain. They don't give that out to anybody.
Well, you know, I can base the argument that the fact that I was an assistant Ryder Cup maybe belies that argument. But Corey saw something that nobody else saw, and that was quite the experience.
Mm-hmm. So to kick things off, I think you're most known for your 59, and I want to know about what went on, you know, the night before the preceding to the 59. You know, was there anything that was different than a usual, you know, night before a tournament?
No, not really. You know, I'd actually been struggling a little bit. I think I'd missed three cuts in a row prior to, and you know, I was going through my usual prep that week, and then Wednesday we played in the pro-am on Wednesday morning, and as soon as we got done, you know, the skies opened up, and I mean, it rained so hard. I remember I was trying to go to a store, and you couldn't get out of your car because it was flooding everything. And so, you know, normally you'd be practicing Wednesday afternoon. That was a Wednesday afternoon. You just kind of watched it at the hotel room and watched it rain, which obviously led to a little easier scoring conditions the next day. But no, nothing. I had no expectations, zero.
Yeah. It's golf's a funny game. And, I remember David Duval saying that he like never hit balls a lot because when he was struggling, he didn't want to hit balls, and when he was hitting it good, he didn't want to hit balls to, you know, lose the rhythm. Was that the type?
If I'm really struggling, sometimes my caddy will talk about going to the range and having a purge, and just trying to get all the bad swings out. I do think there's, you know, I tend to try to do a lot of reflection. So I think some of the best practice I get done is kind of sitting down, like I said, like that Wednesday where it rained, and you can kind of think, hey, I've been struggling. Why have I been struggling? And sometimes, you know, that self-analysis is an important part of it. And I tend to do that a lot too. Having said that, there are times when you just feel lost, and there are plenty of times on the range where I've hit it bad and just said, you know what? I don't need to hit it. I'm going to go practice something else. This is awful. Or even putting, you throw down a ball at 4 feet and try to make 10 in a row, and you can't make one in a row. And sometimes the best thing you can do is just, you know, hey, today's not your day. Tomorrow's another day.
Yeah, I think everybody's been there with like the short putts.
It happens. Yeah. It happens. You know, your alignment gets a little squirrely, and something's just not registering for whatever reason. Maybe you slept funny that night, and your hips got a little out. Who knows? There are things that happen in our sport, and sometimes we tend to, especially younger guys, as I've gotten older, hopefully experienced, sometimes you can kind of practice yourself into a funk, and sometimes you just need to say, step back, take a look, take a breath, and say, tomorrow's another day, we'll go back to work. Mm-hmm.
So has your perspective on just the game and, you know, getting ready for tournaments changed a lot over your career?
Again, that goes back to experience. I'll never forget, middle of my career. I was playing Hartford, and I'd had a really good Tuesday. I played a practice round and really had a good couple. You know, went to the range and really hit the ball really nice. I was really happy with everything. You know, went to the chipping, you know, work on a short game and chipping everything in. And I went to the putting green and making 30 footers. And I remember talking to John Wood, who's a caddy out there. I think he's working for Matt Kuchar now. And So then, you know, hey, this has been kind of, you know, I don't know what to practice now. I'm making everything. I'm chipping in and I'm hitting it good. And he goes, let's just go home. Yeah, you've done, you're good. And then again, the same thing happened. The pro-am got rained down. So I actually took 36 hours, didn't touch a club, and went out and shot, I don't know, 10 or 11 under for the first 2 days. And it's kind of funny how this concept of over practicing. I have 5 hours of daylight. I need to use that. And sometimes as a younger player, you get caught into this. I need to work. And sometimes the best thing you can do is say, hey, things are good. Let's go relax and get ready.
Mm-hmm. I think I find that in my older age, I play amateur stuff, but as I've gotten older, I've practiced way, way, way less. And it seems like I'm almost better than I was when I practiced all the time outside of.
But I think part of that's because we're better at practicing. We get more focused on our practice. We kind of said, you get good at setting goals at your practice. You get good at, you know, just getting better at practicing. You can get more done in an hour when you're at my age now than I could get done at, you know, 2 or 3 hours when I was 25. I didn't really know what I was doing. And so I've gotten a better idea of what it takes and how to play well, what I need to do, what are my strengths, that self-evaluation issue that you need to have if you're going to get better. I mean, honest self-evaluation is something that I don't care what you do for a living, you need to have that. And sometimes it's you stink and you need to go to work, but sometimes, hey, things are good. You need to go rest and be ready to go play.
What, in terms of like self-evaluation, how much has stats changed the way you can do that?
You know, the problem with golf stats is they tend to be, intermixed to some extent. Now they have these new ones, the engineers have come up with about strokes gained, putting and driving and whatnot. And I'm not sure how they work, I'll be honest with you. There was something someone had told me, I don't know if it's true or not, that when I shot 59, I had like the greatest strokes gained putting round and they'd ever measured. I don't know if that was, or at least at that time, I don't know if that was true or not. And I don't know if you even find that out. But the problem you have with some of the stats, let's take, say putts per green in regulation. You know, if I hit a good drive in the fairway and hole 5-iron, I have 0 putts for green in regulation according to this tour. I'm the best putter on tour. Well, that seems odd. I haven't putted. You know, bunkers, you know, sand saves. You know, if I hit it 3 feet and miss it, my sand game, and I'm 42%, that doesn't mean I need to work on my sand game. I need to work on my 3-footers. There's a lot of intermingling, and that's where the evaluation, you need to actually kind of, I would actually say the opposite. You need to be enough self-aware about yourself. And again, I think know thyself is probably the best piece of advice you could give a young player, is know who you are and know what you can do. And again, evaluate. But if I go out and look at the stats and says I'm 42% sand saves, there's a deeper deal there, that you need to dive into. If a player can play for 6 months and can't realize what he's struggling with, then that's another set of problems.
Yeah. I think you see a lot of times when players try and, like, you know, they have a lot of success and then they try and, Martin Keimer famously, I think he was trying to add a fade or a draw. I think it was a draw for Augusta.
A draw.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, Luke Donald, you know, went on a quest for more distance when he was world number one. Did you ever have anything like in your career where you tried to implement something and it just was the wrong move?
No, I never really went down that path. That's not how I evaluated myself. You know, I just take the loop. I can't, you know, for me to be, you know, Martin Keimer when he played bad was a better player than I was, let alone when he played good.
He didn't shoot 59, though.
Not yet, anyway. The Luke Donald issue is, though, again, got the number one in the world. That's a stratosphere that I never even looked at. But he looked at trying to get more length, and that's a – part of that's an age. He's 30s in his 30s, and he's looking at how the game's changing. You know, I've always been a short hitter, kind of. My last 10 years on tour, I was in the bottom 10% in distance. And I never really tried to hit it farther. I said, well, I'm never going to hit it farther. It's not significant. I always tried to figure out a way to hit straighter. I feel if I'm going to hit it, if you're going to drive it short, you have to drive it straight. I mean, if you're hitting it short and crooked, then you know, that's a whole other set of problems that I. So I never tried to make to fix the things that I think were maybe deficiencies. I tried to make my strengths stronger. That was always kind of the way I looked at it, improving my game. For me to be successful, I need to drive the ball in the fairway and you need to make putts. If I do those two things, I'm probably going to be okay. And I always felt that that's kind of, again, goes back to that evaluation. I remember Rory McIlroy saying something kind of similar, saying that, you know, he had a weakness, and I don't know what, to be honest, I don't know what Rory McIlroy's weaknesses are. I haven't really seen them. Saying healthy seems to be his biggest problem. Playing soccer, probably, maybe not high on his list of things he should be doing. But he mentioned that he didn't, his weakness was X. And he said, I don't want to spend so much time trying to make X better that I lose my strength. And I thought that was a very profound thing to say. His strength is driving a golf ball and long and reasonably straight. And that's how he, when he does that, he's very difficult to beat. And I'm the same. I need to drive the ball straight and I need to make putts. And also that's where I'm, the vast majority of my thought process goes, not trying to fix what, you know, deficiencies I might have. You know, obviously if I'm fat hooking five irons, I'm going to go figure out why. But I mean, if I'm more comfortable hitting a draw, I see no reason to work on the fade. I would need to have everything else in such good shape that to where I would do that, make that kind of change would have to be, you know, I'd have to be in a much better, in a great place.
Zach Blair once said to me, and Zach is, despite what he says, he's one of the shorter hitters. He always says, you know, I'm one of the longest hitters on tour. Zach Blair, younger guy.
Yeah. I don't Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He's a shorter hitter, but he hits it really straight. He found himself. He hits driver almost everywhere on tour. Did you find that with like hitting it straight, you know, on tighter holes, hitting driver gave you a, you know?
Yeah, to some extent. To some extent, yeah. I mean, to me, if guys who drive it reasonably straight, who are in the top, say 20 in driving accuracy, tend to hit driver more because they're more comfortable hitting. I think I hit my driver straighter than I hit my 3-wood off the tee. I definitely think I'd hit my driver straighter than I hit, you know, a 4-wood or a long or a hybrid off the tee. It's just to me, unless there's a really compelling reason, and you get holes where, you know, you go out there 250 yards and it becomes 20 yards wide with the hazards, and you're going to lay up, obviously. But generally, I hit my driver just as straight as anything else. And again, it goes back to what I said before. If I'm not driving it good, it really doesn't matter. So if we got a fairway that's 30 yards wide with trouble, if I'm not hitting driver into that fairway the vast majority of the time, I'm probably not having a good week anyways.
Good way to look at it.
Again, you live by the sword and die by the sword a little bit. And you said, these are things that I generally need to do. Now you can obviously get, that's a big long-term concept. There are rounds where you kind of, the driver's not feeling good and you're just getting it in the house to survive that round and get to the range and figure out why you're not doing whatever you need to do. There are times when, again, you get a little bit out of whack and you have to find a way to fix that a little bit. And so I will manipulate the round, or I might hit 3-woods or whatever, just to get the ball in play and get it on the green, get through that round as little damage as possible. That happens. But on a big, from a big picture standpoint, you know, my strength is driving it straight.
Mm-hmm. With your career, like one of the, you know, I guess a stereotype for Californians and Floridians is that Californians don't play well in Florida, and Floridians don't play well in California. But, you know, two of your best tournaments happened in Florida. Did you just buck the trend, or is that just a real thing?
I think it's, again, it was experience. The first time I took a look at Bermuda grass, to me, it was like, you know, I couldn't figure out heads or tails of what was going on there. But, I got through that. I would argue that the bigger problem is going from Florida to California and putting on Poana than going from California to Florida and learning how to put on Bermuda. Bermuda grass now, to me, is much more consistent. You can kind of, if you spend some time and you get some experience, Bermuda tends to be a much better, more consistent putting surface than Californians struggle on Poana too, at times. Going from a place where, you know, you watch the AT&T and that's the way, you know, you've got tough sand, tough soil conditions to grow grass, and you got bumpy grains, and they got quick. And, you know, you just have to accept that some of those horses, Torrey Pines, for example, too, where you're going to miss a couple of 3-footers during the week, even when you hit good putts. That's not the case in Florida. You can get going in Bermuda grass. I don't care who you are. If you get good putts, they generally go in. And it's not a function of, it's a function of dealing with that situation. Californians just deal with missing 3-footers every once in a while when they hit good putts. In Florida, if you, again, if the Bermuda grass is in good shape and you hit a good putt, they generally go in. That isn't the case on Poana sometimes.
Yeah, I lived in L.A. and spent a lot of late afternoons playing Rancho Park, which, you know, those things got pretty bumpy. And from
I grew up in Recreation Park, and you play in the afternoon, bumpy Poana. It's a test of your patience. So, you know, you go from, you know, when you go to Florida and we play wherever, we'll play at Boca Raton and we'll play in Naples. The greens are perfect. They're Bermuda, but they're perfect. And if I hit a 4-footer on the line that's read correctly and it goes in. I've hit plenty of 4-footers at Pebble Beach or Riviera or Torrey Pines, and I thought I hit a pretty good putt on the round. I was trying to hit it, and it just kind of didn't go in. It happens.
It's, people talk about, like, agronomy being a huge thing that's, like, gone through a big, you know, advancement in the game over the last 20 years. Had a career that spanned, like, you know, a long time. Would you say that's really, you know, changed the game?
I think it's changed the professional game. I can't speak for it because we're getting a golf course. They're spending a lot of time to get the golf course fit ready. I mean, a normal golf club doesn't have that kind of money to spend say a tournament site's going to spend to keep the course in tour shape. But having said that, yeah, I mean, the golf course conditioning has lowered scores. And the fairways are better. The grasses need less water and can stay. So the golf, you know, the greens are smoother and stay smoother longer. Soft spikes of the day. You know, if you have firm greens, you don't get a lot of rain. Soft spikes make a big difference over metal spikes, which is, you know, this is what on the PGA Tour can't be more than 25% of the guys are wearing metal spikes anymore. And with firm greens, that makes a big difference, especially for the guys playing in, say, later in the afternoon. But agronomy has made a big, I think agronomy is a big part of why the golf scoring is so much better. People are, you know, you watch major champions. We played the Open Championship at Turnberry, the year that Watson lost in the playoff. And I'm playing pressure with Kevin Sutherland. We're both playing at 4 o'clock on Thursday. So we played like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Wednesday as a practice round. And we got done and the superintendent was on the 18th green and we were just stunned by how good the greens were. And this is 7 o'clock in the afternoon. We're the last guys, you know, 150 guys that played and they hadn't even mowed it yet. And it was perfect. I mean, it was absolutely perfect. And, you know, if you read the green right from 20 feet and hit a putt, you're making it. There's nothing to keep the ball from going on. I don't know if that was the case 25 years ago.
Yeah. With the Champions Tour, you know, the setups are, as I understand it, a little bit more benign with pins more in the middle. Does it make it more of a putting contest?
I wouldn't necessarily. I think that, you know, our pins are all going to be 4 or 5 from the edge. Like the difference is probably more length. You know, we're playing golf courses that are between 69 and 72 or 3. Well, the PGA Tour is playing between 72 or 3 and I'm assuming almost 8,000 now. I think that's a bigger difference. And we're playing golf courses that are take away our majors. But, we just played the Schwab Cup Championship at Phoenix Country Club. We basically played it. The member wanted to put their golf course in the best possible shape they had for their member guest or whatever. That's basically what we're playing. We're playing, you know, rough penal, but not unplayable. Greens are perfect. They're trying to get everything firm, but that's a weather issue. So we're playing golf courses that they aren't trying as hard to make it as difficult either from our fairways, instead of being 20 yards wide, 25 yards wide are going to be 30 to 35 yards wide. Our greens, instead of being trying to get to 12 or 13, we're trying to get to 12, 11 or 12. There's just little slight differences that tend to, you know, bunch the field up and go back to what you're saying, you know, putting. But putting, to answer your question, though, putting There used to be a statement that, you know, you drive for show and putt for dough, and we've obviously proven that that's not the case in professional golf, but everybody's a good putter. Putting is now a prerequisite to being a professional golfer. If you're not a good putter, you're not a professional golfer anymore. It used to be guys could ball strike their way around and be average putters and be pretty consistent and good players. It just isn't the case in the game today, mainly because of the conditioning of the greens.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to the transition from the PGA Tour to the Champions Tour, what would you say is the biggest difference outside of, say, the course setup in, you know, rounds, in three rounds versus four?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that you're playing against your basically one generation of players. You know, generation being about 10 years. You know, most of the players are between 50 and 60. While on the PGA Tour, you might be playing against three or four generations of players. You got 20-year-olds and 45-year-olds playing out there. And so you're playing against, you know, I'm playing against the best of a generation. They're playing against the best of all generations. But once you get inside the ropes, it's the same thing. It's just, the competition's the same. You're trying to do the same things. You're trying to beat the guys and trying to play the best you can. But the difference to me is that I'm only facing, if the PGA Tour were for 20 to 30-year-olds, it'd be very similar. If we had, the Champions Tour is just one generation of players.
Mm-hmm. I sent a tweet out to get some listener questions, and one of our listeners had a question that related on that. With, like, the influx of cash on the PGA Tour now, and do you think that, 15, 20 years from now, there's going to be less players playing past 40?
That question has been brought up, I think, as purses have increased, probably since the 1950s. I mean, I'm sure the people in the 1950s couldn't believe how much money the guys in the 70s were playing for. And the end of the day, you hear a lot of players talk about it, but we all like to compete. You know, once you get past the money, the guys who are really successful, I don't care what sport it might be, and want to compete. And you see that in other sports too. Guys seem to hang on longer than they should because they think they can still compete. They still want to do that compete. In golf, you're lucky. You can do it. I mean, Niger's winning tournaments at 60, and he's going to win tournaments next year at 61. And that drive to compete is always going to be there regardless of where their bank account may be. Everyone talks about, there's these 35-year-old kids who say, I'm not going to play the Champions Tour. And then they're 45, they say, well, we'll see. And then they're 50, they're playing the Champions Tour because this is what we do. And we want to maybe it's ego driven. I don't know, but you want to compete and you want to show your skills off and you want to see what you can do. And you really can't do that they can't do that in other fields. They can go into television and whatnot, but the reality is, what they've been doing their whole lives is competing against their fellow players, and that drive doesn't go away just because your bank account's bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I think that same way. Like, my wife does not understand why I play in, like, mid-am events around the state. She's
sure.
Like, what?
Yeah.
And it's just, there's nothing like competition, and,
it challenges yourself. And Jack Nicklaus talked about retiring when he was 40, and he was still playing the Masters. He almost won the Masters when he was 58. All these guys talked about that. I've always talked about, I'm not going to do this longer than X. And they all end up doing it until they're 60. So there's nothing that tells me that Ricky Fowler's not in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what else are they going to do? Just play money games around?
Well, there's plenty of other
too.
Things. I think there are plenty of things they can do. They're all smart guys. I mean, Tiger, these guys are all really smart guys. But what drives them to be Ricky Fowler is this competitive nature. What drives Justin Thomas to be Justin Thomas is his competitive nature, and that's not going to go away because they're doing golf course architecture or they're doing something else. They're still going to have that desire to compete.
Having played on the Hogan Tour, which was then the Webb, then you played on the
the Webb Tour,
yeah,
then the Hogan Tour.
Yeah, then I got it all mixed up. The PGA Tour and now the Champions.
Right.
How would you kind of contrast the differences? What are, like, the little things that you enjoyed about each? Maybe not the most obvious.
Yeah, the Hogan Tour, I was, I mean, just I had no idea. I'd never played any national level golf ever. In college, I never played in the NCAAs. I never played at USM. Or I'd never really done anything. I didn't even know anybody out there. I didn't even heard of these people, except maybe what you read in Golf Digest. I never really paid that much attention to who was a great player in college golf. I remember Verplank won a PGA Tour event when he was a college player. He won the Western Open, I think, and he played at Oklahoma State, and we played against them, but, you know, I didn't know anything. The Hogan Tour was just kind of like, to me, was the biggest thing, was going out there and playing, and that's when I first realized that, hey, you know, maybe there is a future playing. I was, at that point, I was just gotten my college degree, and I was kind of, you know, hemming and hawing, and, you know, give it a couple of years and see what happens, and I had some success, you know, and it kind of allowed me to kind of reevaluate, in a sense, what my, you know, goals were. My goals were, your ultimate goals would be the best player in the world, but those are, you have other goals too, and just kind of see where this goes, and it kind of went in a good direction, so I kind of kept going, and it, you know, and here I am today. PGA Tour, it's a pretty cool thing. You know, I got to play for whatever it was, 15 years with Tiger Woods, to know that when you're playing a tournament, you're playing against, it's the ultimate challenge. And the European Tour has gotten better, but when I played the PGA Tour, especially early, that week when I won Bay Hill, it was the fifth best field in the world that year. This concept of, and then maybe that's just your ego, that you got a chance to, you're playing against the best possible players and you're one of them, is a pretty cool thing once you step back and take a look at it. Now, you're not thinking that on the first tee, but like in the off season, and especially the last few years now that I've, you know, gotten older and kind of seeing what's going, watching the kids today, I got a chance to do that for 20 years. That's a pretty cool thing. You know, maybe I'm too much of a fan of professional golf, but, you know, having a chance to play with Tiger, I shot 28 playing the first time I played with Tiger Woods, I shot 28 on the front nine, things like that, you know, against the greatest players in the world. That's just a cool thing to be able to do. I see that in other sports, baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. I mean, it's got to be pretty cool to go out and play center field for the Angels when you're Mike Trout. That's a pretty cool thing. And then the Champions Tour, you kind of gets back to what golf is really about. And you know, golf is a great sport. When you're not playing golf, you play golf for 50. If I play a PGA Tour event, if I play a Champions Tour event, I'm actually playing golf for about 15 minutes. You know. I'm hitting my hopefully 65 shots in about 15 minutes. So, you know, you realize how good the people are in golf, because you have all this time to talk and spend time with them. And, you know, I look back over the years, and someone said, how would you describe the PGA Tour? And I go, it's a bunch of guys who you'd love to have as your next door neighbor. And golf tends to breed that in our sport. And that's one of the nice things about the Champions Tour. You go to player dining and you have a choice of 15 different tables you can sit at, and, you know, all 15 of them are going to be pretty good guys, so you're going to enjoy a conversation with while you eat lunch. And I think that best describes our game. The people that end up playing our game for long periods of time tend to understand that part of our game. The people who don't like the etiquette and don't like the slowness and don't like that stuff tend to go play other sports. They get bored when they're 10 years old or 12 years old or 15 years old and move on, while the people that stick it out tend to be, you know, I've always said about the first tee is that, you know, what junior golf makes is not great golfers. It makes great citizens. And golf's always been very good at that.
Yeah. I mean, you could say that we all have, we're all sickos. You know, we are all self-deprecators that like to give themselves a hard time for this pursuit.
Well, golf tends to produce losers. I mean, I played 500 PGA Tour events and I won twice. I mean, I will admit that golf eventually gets to everybody and drives everybody a little bit crazy, but probably in a good way, because it's the greatest players in the world, you know, are losing the majority of the time. And that's difficult to deal with at times.
So you spoke about playing with Tiger a little bit, and I'm curious as to, I've heard a lot of other players talk about, like, there was this intimidation factor. What was it like being in the ropes with him? I mean, obviously, you shot 28 that first time.
Yeah. First of all, Tiger, I probably, I shouldn't say new, but, you know, we grew up in the same place. he was, you know, a 5-year-old kid hitting balls at Hartwell Park, and it's a par 3 course that had a lighted range, and I was, you know, 16 or 17. So we kind of, you know, he grew up in the city next door to me, and we actually, the Navy course, which he talks about playing a lot, where he ran into some trouble because of the color of his skin. My dad was a military guy, and I played golf there a lot too. So it wasn't, Tiger didn't have that same effect on me, because I saw him when he was 5 hitting balls in the range. I mean, I had a different, slightly different perspective of him. Having said that, he's a, you know, good players can know that. They know that you're intimidated, not necessarily by the person, but by his skill set. He didn't intimidate me as a person. He intimidated me because he was so freaking good. I mean, I played with him at the practice round on Wednesday before the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. It was John Cook and Mark O'Meara, myself, and Tiger Woods on Wednesday morning. And I don't know. I don't know if it's intimidating, but there's no way I was going to beat him that week. And I missed a cut, but there was no way anybody was going to beat him that week. And I knew that on Wednesday. And I don't know if that's intimidation or just respect. But I do remember it was an incident. We were playing together at the Buick Open in Michigan. And, you know, you're playing with Tiger, they're going to be 5 deep on every hole, which, you know, we were in the top 20 maybe. And in the fourth hole, I had about a 3 or 4 footer for par, and he'd putted out, and he was just waiting to go to the next tee. And I look up at the hole the last time before I'm going to hit my putt, and somebody takes a picture. Flash goes off. And they weren't taking a picture of me. You know, Tiger was somewhere. But I happened to catch it in my eyes, and I start used to, you know, I was smart enough to back away, and you're blinking, and it was kind of catch you off guard a little bit. And I'm sitting there trying to get my vision just to stop, you know, to get cleared up before I can hit this 3-footer. And I walk in there, and I finally hit this putt and knock it in. And I kind of walking off a Tiger, and I go, "Wow, and I'm thinking he's going to say, you know, sorry, you know, but, you know, whatever. He just said, "Welcome to my world," because it happens to him every shot. You know, he has to deal with that stuff. And, you know, he wasn't intimidating. He was, he just said, this is, if you want to be a great player, this is what you got to deal with. And he dealt with that and still won. I mean, the fact that, again, how he won, how these guys, Nicklaus, I put Nicklaus and him in a similar category, how they could, you know, win at that clip under those circumstances is pretty impressive. We've already forgotten how good Tiger was. We've completely forgotten.
We've completely forgotten. This week with him coming back, it's, you know, I was reading this morning all these, you know, stats, and you've seen it all right. Week with people putting stats out there. I mean, it is right. Unbelievable how good he was.
I remember Jason Day when he won the PGA Whistling Straits, and he played good the rest of that year and into the next year. Maybe he won the match play or something. And they had mentioned that he'd won 7 out of 17 starts, which is ridiculous. I mean, that's just a ridiculous thing to do. On the PGA Tour against the best players in the world, have 7 wins and 17 starts. Tiger did that 7 different times. I mean, that's ludicrous. Again, we Jordan Spieth had a great start to his career, and I don't know if he still does, but might have a chance to be the youngest person ever to win the Grand Slam. You know, the career Grand Slam, anyways. We talk about, you know, yeah. I mean, it's not even. I mean, Tiger compared Jordan Spieth is a great player, maybe the best player in the world. But he's not Tiger Woods. I got news for everybody.
It's. There's a stat that is like Jordan Spieth missed 13 cuts in his career. Tiger's missed 15, and Tiger started his career when Spieth was 2.
Right. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's my favorite stat I read that I'd never heard before was the his 40 European Tour wins is 3rd all time, and he never played 1 full season on the European Tour.
Yeah, my understanding, I thought at one time he was the all-time leading money winner on the European Tour. He was definitely in the top 2 or 3, just based on, you know, the events. You know, there's a dominance there that we've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Have you been watching? What do you expect from, you know, this week? And do you think there's anything left in the tank for return? Obviously,
back to the other conversation. The guy wants to compete. He loves to compete. And there's, you know, he's the ultimate, you know, at that. I would say of all the players we've talked about, I think he loves that competition as much as anybody. Whether his body can allow him to do that's a different question. Again, if he's healthy and can play, he's going to have some another player for all those guys to deal with. He has that intangible that you have to be that good. I mean, there are plenty of players over the years who have had incredible talent, and let's take Tiger Woods, won 70 tournaments and he won, I think it's 14 majors. And you take another player like, say, Davis Love, who won 20 tournaments and one major. Well, Tiger's not five times better than Davis Love. There's an intangible there that Tiger has that Davis didn't have. And Davis is one of the 20 greatest players of all time, maybe 20 or 30 greatest players of all time. And Tiger's that much better. So Nicholas obviously had it too. And there's probably three or four guys. So that intangible doesn't go away. So if Tiger's healthy and can play and can get, you know, like I said, gets a few, some reps under him, there's nothing that tells me that if his body lets him play, he won't be a great player again.
Yeah. Outside of Tiger and in that era, who did you think was the next best player?
Yeah, obviously Phil. I mean, I thought, you know, Phil did it over a longer, Phil was, VJ had good years. Ernie Els had good years. Phil did it over a decade. You know, and Phil hadn't had that swashbuckling attitude. But Phil won, I think Phil's won close to 40 events. I'm not sure exactly what it is. And five majors. And he really didn't start winning. He won, started winning majors a little late in his career, and he still won five. He won three. You know, and there's nothing that says he might not win the U.S. Open in the next few years, too, and win the career Grand Slam. I mean, I think he was definitely the second best player. They had that stat. I don't know if you saw the stat on Twitter about from 1997 to sometime 2000.
Oh, the top
whatever.
50 thing.
Well, the relation to par in major championships. That Tiger was 128 under. Phil was third at like 128 over.
Yes, Steve Fleshy,
a good friend of mine. Fleshy was number two at 250 shots, you know, over, you know, I think it was a 15-year period or something. I mean, but it shows you Phil, you know, Fleshy's an underrated player, and he's tremendous talent. It doesn't surprise me his name was there, but it shows you how good Phil was at that time. I mean, Phil, in a sense, amazing how big a person, Phil's a big personality. I would consider Phil a friend, and I've always liked Phil. To be that big a personality and can be completely overshadowed by Tiger Woods tells you, how great Tiger Woods was.
Yeah, it's a good point. My listeners are going to get after me. I always contend Ernie was number two in that era. So
Ernie definitely competed. It's hard sometimes. Ernie's still slightly in the era where the European Tour and the PGA Tour were apart. So it's hard to measure. You know, Nick Faldo, how do we measure? How do you measure Colin Montgomery? How do you measure some of these guys? Nowadays, it's a little easier because there's a lot more competition among the top players from both tours, or from the world, I guess now you'd call it. Back then, Ernie still was bouncing back and forth, and we didn't have the ability to. So Ernie could be a reasonable choice there. It's just harder to figure out because there wasn't so much inter-tour competition.
Yeah, if you look at their major championship stuff, they're so close. It's
right.
You know, I think they're separated like all-time top tens is like they have like one or two
right.
You know, between them, and you know, one win more for Phil.
Right. And Phil has, again, Phil's a bigger personality.
Yeah.
And so that tends to help him in those types of rankings too.
American too, you know, there's this American bias.
Sure. Sure. There.
So with the kind of spanning this era, there's been a lot of talk about bifurcation in the game. You know, where do you kind of stand on the golf ball and technology?
Well, again, this is, you know, we're running a business, and we can talk a lot about how, and I think some of these concepts, well, first of all, this concept that we need to play 8,000 yard golf courses is an interesting concept. I know Chambliss talked about it a lot on Twitter. Chambliss is fun to follow because he'll always say crazy stuff. And, but again, no one, if you look on the PGA Tour, I'd say the two courses that play the shortest on tour are Hilton Head and Colonial. No one's shooting 30 end at par there. They're shooting actually higher. I bet the stroke average of those relation to par is higher than average on tour. So length is not the end all, the be all. I remember we at the Houston Open. I don't know, got 20, 15 years ago. They switched over to this place, this Redstone. I think it's called the Houston Golf Club now. But we played the members course the first couple of years, and the back nine was a little over 4,000 yards long. And I remember playing the practice round and getting done. And God, I just hit a bunch of three woods every hole. What the hell? So I added it up. It was like 4,030 yards. It was the back nine. I'm thinking, holy, that's long. And they shot, and Craig Couples, I think, won that year. He shot 22 under par. Length is not going to deter scoring. So the ball, you know, for all the greatness that the golf ball has, which it goes farther and spins less, well, there's a way to for architects to deal with that. You know, just watch the tour players play the 10-foot Riviera and how bad they mess it up. You see a lot of you see twos and you see sixes. You know, length is an apple's a three wood. It's a three wood par four for all these guys, and they struggle with. So there's ways to deal with it. That the golf ball is harder to control distance wise. So there's ways for architects to fix that through making distance control being more important than, you know, being able to hit your pitching wedge. You know, Marion for the U.S. Open, Phil Mickelson. You know, he had a pitching wedge into, I think it's 14, the par three, maybe it's 13, whatever the short par three is by the clubhouse. And then the next hole, he had two wedge shots that he hit the wrong distance, and he went bogey bogey and lost U.S. Open. Not because he didn't play a 550 yard par four well, but because he didn't hit a wedge at the right distance. And the architect, we need to figure out a way to make distance control more important. And when you do that, then the players will demand a ball that they can control better. But right now, we're not doing that with architecture. We're just making it longer to where distance control is less important.
I had Bill Coore on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he said when a reporter called him about, you know, how he was going to combat the distance problem with Trinity Forest, he said, you know, I want to make golf courses shorter and wider and make it more about them hitting it the right distance and the right line, you know, where it's, you know, they have to pick a line and they have to hit it, execute the distance. On that line.
What's the hardest hole in major championship golf under pressure? It's not, it's 12 at Augusta, which forces you to either hit it at the right side of the green. It's forced you to hit the right club. You hit it at the right, you know, and it just throw a little bit of wind in there and guys struggle because distance control is harder with the new golf ball. If you hit your 9-iron 160 yards, 150 yard shot's a lot harder. But if you hit your 7-iron 160 yards, 150 yard shot is a lot easier. I think that mathematically makes sense, being skilled being the same. So when they start hitting the ball farther, it makes the gaps between the clubs bigger. So architects, Chamblee would bury me on Twitter with this, but to me, lengthening the golf courses plays into the hands of the long hitters into the golf ball while shortening and tightening, and again, what Bill Coore is saying, making guys hit at the right distance. And you do that with angling greens and whatnot. You know, we're hitting it 20 feet pin high left is no good, or 20 feet pin high right's no good. You know, that makes them hit the ball not only the right distance, but also the right, you said, the right line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And it's, you know, I think that's where Dye changed everything with Harbortown, was he reintroduced this idea of, like, it's not just about hitting it long and straight, it's about hitting it straight and the right distance. And
right, you know, Colonial's like that. And again, Colonial, you got the ball in the fairway.
Yeah.
In Fort Worth, you just have to hit the ball in the fairway.
Yeah, and it takes driver out of so many of those guys' hands because of those dog legs and
stuff. Right, you got to shape it, which is harder to do with today's ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's harder to hit shots because the ball doesn't spin enough.
That's I noticed with all the, you know, like the famous shots from 1999 versus the famous shots from like 2017. You don't see any. All of the shots today are just these towering, you know, three woods or irons, right? Dead straight
right.
play versus, you know,
right.
the recovery shot.
But there's a pretty big caveat here, and I think that's not talked about. And the professional golfers of today are taking advantage or figuring out what do I need to do to be successful. If tomorrow they decided to completely to shorten the golf ball, make it spinnier, and make driving accuracy and distance control the most important thing in golf, and if you could do those things, you wouldn't be any good. After a couple of years, the same guys would be on top.
Yeah, they just figured it out.
So I do think, yeah, because the best players figure this out. Best players are the best players for a reason. So, you know, back in the day when Tiger and Phil, if driving at, when they weren't driving it great, if driving accuracy were the most important thing in golf, those guys would have had a totally different style of play and would still be the best players. They've adapted themselves and figured out the best way to be competitive under these circumstances. And the great players do that. So some of this stuff to me, some of this stuff to me is a little cringeworthy when I hear about the way the game is played today. Well, that's a chicken and egg issue. And I think it's very unfair to today's top players to say, well, the ball and this and that and the other thing. Well, that they're playing the equipment that they've been given and figured out the best way to be competitive with that equipment. And so to say that that equipment is why they're good, I think is completely wrong. I think it's the other way around. These guys are great players and they figured out how to be the best with the equipment in today's stands. If Jack Nicklaus were playing today, he'd be playing like those guys.
Yeah, I think TrackMan is underrated in it too, because it's taught everybody how to, you know, get to where they're perfectly optimized.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I mean, I've never done that. I like what Dustin does with TrackMan, where he optimizes distance. He figures out how far to hit each shot. He's turned into the best short iron wedge player in the world from the fairway, you know, according to stats. And that says that's got to be pretty scary if you're Rory McIlroy, and he hits where he hits, and he turns into a great player from 150 yards. But again, I think it does a disservice to our top players. I think that they're not there because of the equipment. They're there because they're the best players, and don't ever forget that.
So I want to get you out of here. We had some listener questions I wanted to get to real quick.
Okay.
Sean Martin, friend of the pod, and you know, longtime golf writer, wants to know your best story from days as a substitute teacher.
Wow, I mean, you can't repeat those. Substitute, do you have secrets? You know, we're hoping substitute teaching stays in substitute teaching. I got lucky one time. I tell the story. I was working a seventh grade PE class, and some kid behind I'm trying to take roll so I can roll out some basketballs, and they can do whatever they want to do for half an hour. And so PE is always a little chaotic. I'm trying to they have a system where you stand at a number, and whatever numbers aren't anybody standing on, that's who you mark absent. And this kid was behind me while I'm taking roll, and he had his gym shorts, you know, down around his thighs and his shirt tucked in, and he was dancing and whatnot. It's a long story. I hope you have time.
No, and I hope you have time.
And kids are giggling and whatnot, and I finally figure out there's something that's going on, and I go, hey, you quit stopping like an idiot and get out your number. And he goes, hey, you can't call me an idiot, he says to me. I go, well, I didn't call you an idiot. I said, you're acting like an idiot, but get on your number. And he goes, well, he starts giving me lip about it. I say, hey, look, you know, I'm a substitute. I don't care. Why don't you head on down to the office? I'll just mark you absent, and you can deal with it tomorrow. It's not my problem. And so I sent him off to the office, and he goes to the office, and I finish roll and finish the class, and you have to go back down to the school, and you grab a little card that you sign out, and that's how they know you were there. And nobody signed me out, and the principal doesn't know it on my card saying, go talk to the principal. And I go, oh, come on. I don't need to go to the principal's office. So I did that when I was a kid. I don't need to do it now. And so I walk in there, and he goes, hey, did you send a kid down here? I go, yeah, I did. And he goes, you said you called him an idiot. And I go, well, no, I didn't. So he's acting like an idiot. And he goes, well, we don't like to use that kind of language with our kids, which might be reasonable. And then, well, I know. And I go, hey. You know, this is, he has a dictionary on his desk. And I go, open the dictionary and look up the word idiot. And he's kind of looking at me, just do it. And he said, I don't know what it's going to say. So I said, I explained to him what his student was doing. And he had his gym shorts down around his knees and his shirt tucked in, and he was dancing like whatever behind me. And again, he looks up at me. I go, what's the first word under idiot? Now, I don't know. I have no idea what it's going to say. And the thing it says is buffoon, which is just stupid luck. This is dumb luck on my part. And so I go, look, I don't know what kind of school you're running here where you think it's okay to ask your students to act like this. But, you know, if you don't want me, again, they have a massive shortage of substitute teachers. They probably still do today. And I go, if you don't want me coming back here and teaching your classes, I'll be more than happy to tell them not to send me here anymore. And I'll, you know, more than happy to tell all the other substitute teachers not to come here either. And they kind of looked at me, looked at the dictionary, looked at me, signed the card, said, no, I think we're okay. But that was probably the luckiest thing. It's maybe one of the five luckiest things that's ever happened to me, because it could have said anything. And it said buffoon, that particular dictionary. I said buffoon. I go, this is exactly what he was acting like. Maybe you guys need to do a better job of getting your kids to act better.
You know, I feel like buffoon needs to be used more in the...
Yes, it's a great word.
It is. It's quite a, if you call somebody a buffoon, it's pretty insulting.
Yes, it is. I agree.
That's funny. So IDK in Massachusetts wants to know, wants you to rank Rec Park, Skylinx, and El Dorado in best to worst.
Well, I mean, I'm biased. Rec Park's one of the great municipal courses, you know, the original Virginia Country Club. And it's been around since, you know, Rec Park's been around 100 years almost. And I would argue Rec Park's one of the great municipal golf courses in the country, if not the world. So that's an obvious number one. Skylinx, El Dorado's probably two, and Skylinx three. They redid Skylinx, but for no apparent reason. The old Skylinx used to be fun. They used to have a game out there on Fridays, and you go out and play. And guys, you know, you get a guy out there with, you know, a 16-pack of beer and a broken forewood and seven irons and a putter and shoot 65 all day long. And it was a fun game to play with. And El Dorado, they've done a good job. You know, what they've done up for municipal golf courses, you know, like my, what I would say is you go play, I haven't played Skylinx much lately, but El Dorado and Rec Park are in terrific condition considering they're getting, I don't know how many rounds of golf they get. They got to get 100,000 rounds a year there. It's amazing.
It's, let's say,
Rec Park's iconic. Rec Park's iconic, in my opinion.
Rec Park's?
It's like Rancho Park.
Produce a lot of PGA Tour players.
If I have a few guys, John Merrick, you know, you go back to the Jamie Mulligan deal. I wouldn't surprise me if Patrick Cantlay played some at Rec Park growing up. You know, there's a story that hasn't, you know, it's starting to get told. But what Patrick Cantlay did last year, you know, going off on a tangent about Long Beach. I mean, here's a guy who took off, didn't play for 4 years, you know, injuries and whatnot. You know, had his best friend and caddy die in his arms, get hit by a car. Show up last year, play 12 events, make 12 cuts, make tour championship, and then win his second start. So in the last 14 events, he's made 14 cuts as a win, made a tour championship. I mean, how many guys in the history of the sport could have taken 4 years off between 21 and 25 and then made the tour championship in 12 starts? I can think of about three. Nicholas and Woods and maybe Hogan. Hogan got hit by a bus and won three majors. So I got to give him some. Very few people could have ever accomplished that. And I don't know that story is being told. And then he won, obviously, won at Las Vegas here in the fall. I mean, this kid is unbelievably good. I mean, I played with him and a few times, and it's, you know, he's better. He just went out and playing with us at Virginia. He's better than I ever was. And just talk about a limitless expectations. That guy's going to be a really good player for a really long time.
Yeah, I hope he stays healthy. I did this article last year.
It's a lot of work.
I did this article 25. The top 25 Americans under 25, and I was going through it, and I, you know, I having, you know, playing amateur golf, you remember Patrick Cantlay, you know, like, and right. I saw he was still 24. I was like, he's got to be in this top 25, and then he came back. I was so excited, but people forget, like, you know, like, this was a guy that completely overshadowed Spieth at that same age. Like, you know, like, it was Patrick Cantlay. I mean, what he did when he was 19 was out of this world. I'm really excited. If we can get, you know, 10 great years of Patrick Cantlay, that'd be really awesome. I love his demeanor on the course too.
He's got a good plan. He's got a good plan about himself, and, you know, him and Jamie have really worked hard and done a lot. You know, it's obviously, you know, I'm a big Jamie Mulligan fan, who's his teacher, and Jamie Mulligan has taken three kids, basically high school kids, made them tour players. I don't know if anybody's ever, you know, I understand that Butch Harmon's a great teacher, but he made Tiger Woods better. Well, I think I could make Tiger Woods better. Cantlay, you know, he took John Merrick, Patrick Cantlay, John Malinger. These guys were just high school kids / college kids who just kind of, especially Merrick and Cantlay, is just kids' junior programs at their club, turned them into tour players and tour winners now. You know, that's unprecedented, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's, I feel like, yeah, that is a story that probably should be told.
Yeah, we won't say what Jamie's done for John Cook and Luke List and Peter Tomasulo, myself, I mean, there's a long list of people who have worked with. Luke List worked with him for a year and went from a guy struggling to keep his card. He had a great year last year, and I expect he's going to have a great year this year.
Yeah, he. I mean, he was a top 20 machine last year, and
yeah, he's a really good player.
He hits it so far. It's such a It's like that's a guy with a ton of potential. Let's say you look at a guy that could win five times in 2 or 3 years.
And
he's definitely one of them.
Jamie's got another guy, Max Homa, who's worked with. Who's a really good player.
Uh-huh. He's a funny guy just from following him on Twitter.
Yeah.
So we do this thing. We want to get you out of here so we don't take up too much of your time. We do this overrated, underrated. So it's just question. Mm-hmm. You gotta say overrated or underrated. There's no properly rated.
Okay.
All right. Mock turtlenecks.
Oh, way underrated.
You know what? They might be ripped down so much that they could be underrated.
No, they're way underrated. They're very comfortable.
They are comfortable,
especially guys that don't have shoulders and big necks.
All right. Now that Furyk posted 58, is 59 watch overrated? And this is from Derek Goss.
Yes. Yeah, overrated. The 59 watch is overrated. I think that there's been enough of them there, and Furyk shooting 58 changes things a little bit, sure.
Somebody asked this, and I forgot to write down. Who was more pissed after your 59? Stricker, that he wasn't leading after shooting 60, or you, that you were only leading by one after shooting 59?
It had to be me. I mean, I woke up the next morning, went to Starbucks, came back, turned the computer on, I was three back. Not only was I not leading the tournament, I was three back. He almost held it on the last hole, too. I think he almost caught the edge of the hole, almost held it for 59 on the last hole with, like, a long iron or something.
That was during his run there where it was...
Hey, he won every year. Yeah, I mean, beating Stricker at John Deere was like beating Tiger at Firestone. You know?
Between him and Zach Johnson, it was those guys, that golf course just tailor-made for that. I mean, they're local guys.
I agree.
Too. It's,
I agree.
But that's an example, not a long course.
No. And again, that golf course, if you played there in the fall, we played there right in the middle of summer where they can't get it firm. You played there in the fall when it got firm, you wouldn't see the scoring like that. It's a better golf course than that. It's just, you can't play everywhere at the perfect time of year.
I grew up and we'd have like tournaments in October there. It was tough, especially if it was cold.
Not an easy. it gets firm. It's not that easy.
Yeah, cold and windy and firm. That place has teeth.
Right.
All right. The last one from Al Pandera. The button, mm-hmm. the top button, butting the top button of your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Overrated, underrated?
Way underrated. I mean, again, that button's there for a reason, isn't it? I mean, I never, again, when you have a big neck, and I have like a 19-inch neck, 19 and a quarter inch neck, I make dress shirts. So if I don't button the top button of my shirt, I need to have a gold chain to play, but shirt would be, the collar would be so flayed. That's why I do it. There's a collar. I mean, if I had like a little neck and the button, it just stayed right there. But if I don't button that button, my whole shirt opens up like, a 1970s disco dancer.
See, that's an interesting perspective. I am so anti the top button, but I have a skinny neck.
Right. So it wouldn't make sense for you.
When I do it, I'm like, God, this just doesn't, this would never look right. But
I'm not the only person that does. Somebody else is doing it now too. I don't know who. I thought I saw somebody else had done it.
Bubba does it, and
there you go.
I mean, Duvall did it for a while. Tiger did it for a while.
Yeah, of course.
That's some good company, Duvall and Tiger.
Exactly. Bubba's won two Masters. Talk about the Masters is the most overrated golf tournament in the world.
Yeah, do you think that has to do with them playing the same course every single year?
I think that has a lot to do with. I think Augusta is the smartest of the four majors. They're the smartest people. They make the show the golf course. The USGA makes the show par, and but they do such a great job. But they have no problem. They love it, a matter of fact, when Nicholas shoots 65 and making eagles the last day and making hitting good shots and being nobody rewards good play more than Augusta National on Sunday. no tournament, and they do. So there's not. It's the most underrated telecast, but from a tournament standpoint, to me, it's overrated. But they do such a great job of creating drama with their golf course. They aren't trying to make it play the hardest on Sunday. They're trying to make it play the most exciting on Sunday. And every other tournament misses that. Every tournament misses that. They're always talking about Sunday pins. Well, the Sunday pins at Augusta are a lot of the easiest ones.
They're in the funnels 16, and the bowls.
18, 16, 18's in the bowl. But then 17's in a very difficult spot where you make a mistake, it's problematic. They have perfected golf course setup, in my opinion, from a hole location standpoint. Perfected it. And nobody else does that.
Well, the players is starting, you know, the PGA Tour has done such a smart thing with the players having it at Sawgrass year in, year out. Because
right.
now
helps.
When you come down the stretch at Sawgrass, everybody knows what's coming. Versus yeah. when you play, you know, a U.S. Open at, you know, Erin Hills or Chambers Bay, nobody has a clue what's going on.
Right, right. And again, but the USGA is trying to make – USGA is trying – and also they would never stick the pin. If the USGA ran the U.S. Open at Augusta National on 16 on Sunday, the pin wouldn't be there. So you wouldn't see all the drama. The Tiger Woods chip in, which one of the great, almost iconic shots in golf when he beat DeMarco. Nicholas almost holed it there in 86 when he won. They wouldn't put the pin. They'd put the pin back right and everybody making double. And everybody kind of going, oh, okay. You know, the year that Zach shot, I think it was Zach shot one over par and won the tournament. You know, taking away from Zach, but I'm sure the ratings weren't as good. When you get bad weather and over par wins Augusta, it's not as good. And, you know, when you get 15 under par and you get a guy, birdie in the last four holes to win, that people love that stuff.
Yeah, that's a good finish. It's
it's not like everyone's doing it either. Augusta spreads it out on Sunday. You get two or three guys with a chance to win. There's plenty of guys shooting 75 on Sunday when other guys are shooting 65.
Last question. If one course that never hosts tournaments that you'd love to see, say the PGA Championship could go anywhere, and this is, you know, and they didn't have to worry about grandstands or anything, and
right.
it would be the permanent host of the PGA Championship, where would you go with it?
To me, the best golf course I've played is Pine Valley. And I think it'd be, again, I think Pine Valley would be very similar to Augusta National. I think you'd see lower scores than you'd expect. 10 or 15 under might win the tournament. But I think even par could finish, sixth or seventh. So it would spread things out. Guys would get rewarded for good shots and penalized for bad shots. So that's really what we're looking for. You know, the USGA tends to penalize bad shots and good shots at times. Augusta, very rarely does Augusta National penalize a bad shot. I mean, a good shot. Very rarely. And Pine Valley's like that. Pine Valley tends, if you go out and play good, you can shoot a good score there. I know that, but if you don't play well, man, you can shoot a million there. And I mean a million. And I like that. I think another golf course is like that, though. Maybe, again, the equipment may have changed, is Cypress Point. It's a golf course that if you play good, you can shoot 7 or 8 under par. You play bad, you can shoot 80 in a hurry. And that's a great thing about golf. Too many golf courses are today, we've gotten into this golf course and gone hard where a good round is 70 and a bad round is 95. I'd rather see a golf course where a good round is 65 and a bad round 75.
Yeah, I agree. I love golf courses that allow you
and
to
Augusta,
score.
Yeah, Augusta does that a great job of that.
Mm-hmm.
For the pros.
Yeah. We're on the same page there. I'm excited to see Trinity Forest, a modern design by, a great architect. That's, I think, what's kind of lacking with the, the explosion and the driving distance is that, some of the golf course, playing, but, these guys don't design golf courses for the PGA Tour pro, so that's.
Right. We need more of that, too. We have too many golf courses being designed for pros and not enough golf courses being designed for the everyday player.
Yeah.
This concept of 17 sets of tees to me is bad for our game, not good for our game. It takes away from what's great about our sport is that everyone kind of plays the same course, and the golf ball has affected that a little bit. But we don't golf course should have three sets of tees. They should have a front, middle, and back, and that's all you really should need. And if you need more than that, then maybe you got to look at your design and not necessarily look at and figure out how to make holes longer.
Yeah, yeah. figure out how to make them wider.
Again, I told this to Phil, and he didn't. But I tried to have this conversation that the biggest deterrent, you know, rough to me is the worst hazards in golf, and it just penalizes. You know, if you get a golf course like the U.S. Open and you go 20-yard wide fairways and knee deep rough, that favors long hitters, but does not favor short hitters. Because everybody drives in the rough, and if you're long in the rough, you might be able to get it up by the green, but if you're short in the rough, you're chipping out. So I always thought that if you really wanted to make it fair, I think trees are great deterrents. I think real dog legs are great deterrents. And again, wind and then firmness and then angles, you know, forcing players to hit the ball on pick a line and hit it on that line. If you don't, you're going to be penalized and hitting it the right distance. That's how you make the game harder. As opposed to just, let me tell you something, from an architectural standpoint, I don't mean that if you have a 520-yard par four, that's difficult. All you need is a tee, a fairway, and a green. You don't need anything else. To make a 330-yard par four difficult, you actually need some imagination and some skill. I mean, take the 14th hole at Muirfield Village, one of the great short par fours in golf. Jack did a good job of making you hit the ball on the right line the right distance. 12th hole at Augusta National is a perfect example of that. Anybody can make a 250-yard par 3 hard. It's not that difficult. You just need a tee and a green. That's it. You know, it could be anything. And it's going to play difficult. It's making the short one, the one where everyone can play difficult, that challenges good players and allows bad players to play. That's the skill in architecture that we seem to be losing a little bit.
Yeah, I talk about narrow fairways and it favoring the long hitters so much. You know, if you miss a fairway, like the 20-yard wide fairway, everybody's going to miss a handful of times. You know?
Well, again, the straightest driver on tour, it's about 10 out of 14 fairways. And the most crooked driver on tour hits about 7.
Yeah. That's, and
so it's 3 fairways.
I think that's why you saw so much variety at Erin Hills, was because these fairways were wide and guys could go out and hit 12 fairways.
But I thought it was a good tournament. The USGA doesn't like those kinds of scoring. I mean, didn't he shoot 15? I don't know what he shot there. A pretty decent amount under par.
16, maybe, or 15.
16 under par. But again, I think that's where the USGA is wrong, is that score is the champion. It wasn't hard to figure out who the best player that week was. And to me, that means you've done your goal. You know, when Rory shot 16 under at Congressional, it wasn't hard to figure out. It's not like some fluky guy who didn't. He deserved to win. And you guys are into this. You go back and the lower the score is in relation to par, almost invariably, the more worthy the champion was. You know, when 2 over par wins, Orville Moody wins. When 8 under par wins, Jack Nicklaus wins.
That's a great point.
And Augusta does it again. I hate to say this, Augusta does a great job with that too. But when you see really low scores in major championships, a lot of times it's Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus and guys who, well, okay, Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth. I mean, I think this Koepka guy, I can't even pronounce his name. This guy, holy, he can really play. Man, he's going to win a lot of major championships, I would guess.
Yeah, he's got a lot of game. There's not much.
He has a lot of game.
Yeah, he hits it great. He putts well and he chips well. It's not like there's any holes. So
there's none.
Well, hey, Paul, I appreciate the time. And
yeah, no problem.
And I'll see you. You guys got the senior players at course I grew up playing around and at.
Is it called Exmoor?
Exmoor, yeah. Old school Donald Ross course. So
perfect.
We'll see you out there in next summer.
Yeah, come find me.
All right. Thanks a lot. And
thank you.
All right, bye.